This is Series 3 of Brave New Girl podcast, and I'm Lou Hamilton, author and illustrator of Brave New Girl, How to Be Fearless, and I welcome you to the stories of real-life Brave New Girls who are creatives, founders, campaigners, health practitioners, and thought leaders who are making a positive impact in the world. This week's guest is Penny Power OBE, a pioneer in the world of online business networking with the Academy, which eventually lost its foothold when LinkedIn came along. With her business, home, and mental health swept from under her, she rose again to build a whole new way of being a leader in life and business. And her book and brand, Business is Personal, were born. Welcome, Penny, to Brave New Girl podcast. Hi, Penny. How are you?
Very well. Wonderful to be here with you, Lou.
Lovely to have you. I'm very excited today because this is our first day where we're sort of being gradually allowed to step out, and the swimming pool I go to reopened and it's an outdoor pool, but it snowed today. So I'm not quite sure that I'm brave enough to go for a swim.
I know. I did think it was very ironic for all the hospitality companies that the first day they're able to open up that there was snow. Weird.
I know. So we are hopefully seeing the beginning of the end. And I wonder how the pandemic has been for you. And you support a lot of business owners. So I wonder how you've all adapted and what you've learned, what's been good for you and what's been tough.
So let me talk about my clients first. So what I do with my clients is try and really motivate them to build their business models that feels right for them, but also does embrace technology and the way that people want to buy their services now. And, you know, we have to productize our services. It's very, very important. And so a lot of my clients had resisted it. So actually it's been very rewarding for me to be able to see the clients that I mentor through our mastermind and BIP 100 actually dive in and start to create very different business models, and they're loving it. So that has been a real positive. I think the positive has been our personal and skills development, hasn't it? So so for me, it was a bit of a shock because Thomas and I have been through many business challenges, and, you know, some of it really not under our control. And some of it, you look back and you think, could we have noticed something earlier and made some differences? But we had created a very safe business. Thomas is a non-exec director for a number of companies. Obviously, I love my public speaking that I do. And when I wrote my book, Business is Personal, I got people asking me if I could mentor them. And I said, well, I really believe in the power of groups. And so we created mastermind groups, because I really do believe the group dynamic is so powerful when you need coaching or supporting and you're not listening to just one perspective and you'll rise together. So we created masterminds. So we had three mastermind groups that all met offline, and we actually were sort of feeling very happy with our business model because we thought, well, nothing can disrupt this. We haven't got any investors. We haven't got anything that could possibly disrupt this. It's not like we're doing something that innovative. Maybe we're innovating inside the group, but, you know, masterminds have been around for over 200 years. And then the pandemic struck and I just couldn't believe it. But what surprised me about myself is that how I handled it this time, I seemed to feel a lot more embracing of, you know, of change and these things happen. And I went into shock and out of shock and into innovating very quickly this time. So, you know, that's been really exciting from a business point of view. It gave us the opportunity to start an online community game, BIP 100. But rather than create a machine like we had before with Academy, we created it just 100 clients, which means there's a huge amount of intimacy both with them for us and also between one another. And they're very family orientated. When a new member comes in, they welcome them to the family and they're really supporting each other. So it's beautiful. And I wouldn't have created that without the pandemic. So grateful for that. Three other things that have happened as a result of the pandemic have been more personal, which is amazing. One was we decided to move more into the countryside, which we've been living in Farnham Town Centre for years. And that's been lovely. And we bought a motorhome so that we could do more travel. And that's been incredible.
I saw those pictures. They looked fantastic. You look so happy.
It's such an enjoyable thing. And it's not glamorous, you know, but our holidays in the future will be very much orientated around that. And I love it. And then we bought electric bikes, which aren't what they sound like. They do make you keep fit, makes you go a lot further. So we've sort of, and, you know, every morning now I have at least an hour and a half, 2 hours to myself before I start work. We go for a walk and I do a bit of yoga. And so, you know, I'm not saying it's not been without challenges. I've missed people. It's been a very hard road thinking about what new business can we create. We definitely, you know, our year last year was lower than most of the years that we've had before. So I'm not wanting to sound smug here, like it's been easy, but we've embraced it and had some, I suppose we've found some new values in our lives and aligned ourselves to that, which is lovely.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have found that, haven't they? That they've been sort of forced to look at what's really, really important.
Yeah.
You've been a long-term believer in the need for human beings to connect with each other. And whilst the pandemic sort of stopped that sort of physical connection between people, it has enabled people to connect via technology and people that might not otherwise have done. But people have also felt a sense of overwhelm with that, with sort of constant Zoom meetings and sort of back-to-back calls. And so from your perspective of seeing how important it is to connect and that, you know, we couldn't, you know, physically, how have you seen that sort of growing and the benefit of that?
Well, I think different people interpret connections differently. To me, you know, I've always seen social networking and social media very differently. And, you know, when we started Ecademy, it was very much social networking. And we also started it on the belief that you should become friends in business and not look for the transaction. And that's the culture we created. Because, you know, I did a blog in 2001 called When Emotional Wealth Leads to Financial Wealth. And I strongly believe that if you have emotional connections and emotional support around you, you're going to be much stronger to be able to build your business. So I think, you know, what's happened in the pandemic is some people have thrown themselves into automating stuff, broadcasting a lot, using technology, but I think they've isolated themselves even more. And others have said, this is my chance to spend more time having deep conversations. And it's, you know, if you actually consider that most social networks do allow us to go into a private message with one another, I think not enough people realize the importance of making a connection and then trying to create the conversation inside that connection. You know, just a like or a share or these sort of social media based connections are shallow compared to what you can create in your life if you take time out to curate yourself some good new connections where you become friends with them in business. So, you know, business loneliness is epidemic. And I have this business's personal health check, and it's 42 questions around the broad range of business, you know, the hard skills as well as the soft skills in business. And I always ask in it, do you ever feel lonely in business? And over 50%, even before the pandemic, and now it's sort of going up towards 60% of people are saying, yeah, I do feel lonely in business. And business loneliness isn't sort of an emotional thing. It's also a financial thing. It's an economic impact when you're lonely in business because, A, keeping your mojo going and know you still matter can be hard when you don't have those deeper connections. It doesn't help you to innovate. You're not necessarily learning and hearing enough about the market because you're possibly broadcasting onto it rather than listening to it enough. So it can stop you from innovating. It definitely stops you getting deeper, more relevant referrals to your business. So there's an economic impact of loneliness. And that's why we build these very tight, small communities of people where we encourage friendship within them. And then we absolutely watch their businesses grow because the output of somebody investing in me as a business mentor, either directly or through joining one of our groups, I have to make sure their business grows. And that's always very important to me when I'm looking at the efficacy of what we do, is somebody's business growing as a result of this? But most of the time it grows because they grow in confidence, they get new ideas, they get better referrals. And so that's where I think connecting, you have to really look at yourself and say, am I actually using these new machines that help us connect properly? And is it actually enhancing my business?
And you're a really good person to be mentoring other business owners, because you've sort of seen all sides of growing a business and a business sort of falling away because of numerous things that have happened sort of out with your control. You seem to be someone that on the outside manages to roll with the punches. And I wonder whether as a child, you know, is that in your nature, or is that something, were you a resilient child, or was it something that you developed as you grew? I mean, is it something that we all can develop as we grow?
Oh, that's a great question. I do think I was resilient as a child. You know, I knew I was loved, and that is good. That's good. I knew my parents loved me. But they were from a different generation, obviously. And, you know, I'm a baby boomer, but my parents were, they actually come from what's called the silent generation. So a lot of us, so I'm 57, a lot of us have been brought up by people in the silent generation. And the silent generation were brought up by the greatest, what's called the greatest generation. And the greatest generation fought in two great world wars, or definitely were impacted by them. So my grandfathers and grandparents that brought up my children were very different parents, because, you know, the world that they saw and the challenges they faced. So my parents, the reason that generation is called the silent generation is because they were actually encouraged to be silent about their emotions, and they were encouraged to be very dutiful. So if you think about, both my parents are Scottish, and they were evacuated, and, you know, for many, many years, one were brought up on a farm with people that didn't care about them. My father then went into a pretty tough boarding school. I very rarely saw his parents through for a number of years. And in school, they were told, you know, be strong, stiff upper lip, look at what your parents have done to give you the world that you've got. And it's your job to make this world great and not complain. And so you have to be very forgiving of that, if that's what's important to them. And they were brought up where the highest priority for their parents was their food on their children's plate. Our parents were very much brought up with, you know, educate yourself and do well. Our generation, the baby boomer generation, are bringing up our children to have a sense of purpose and find happiness. It's quite interesting, the cultures that we are growing up in all the time. So, yes, as a child, I was very self-sufficient with my emotions, because I didn't have parents who would sit on the end of my bed and talk through, you know, bullying at school or a boyfriend dumping you or any of those challenges. So I do think I had an inbred resilience, but I did have an inbred feeling of who I was in life and what mattered to me. I did experience loneliness as a child, which is probably why I really focus on loneliness for other people, because I was the youngest of four siblings, and I was at home for quite a while before after they left home. There was quite big gaps, and my parents weren't particularly happy. My mum, I think, had depression. Actually, I think she, I now look back. So I spent a lot of time on my own. We lived in a very remote village. So I did experience loneliness, but next door, somebody moved in when I was about 11 with a cerebral palsy child called Toby. And I ended up dedicating my life to going and seeing Toby, and always thank the parents for letting me do that. And I got a huge amount by the fact that I cared and loved Toby, and that Toby loved seeing me. And I think that was a very big pivotal moment in my self-esteem and self-worth. And it's also where I learned that your self-worth and self-esteem comes from caring for others, not being too introspective on yourself. And I think through the pandemic, we have become quite introspective and have focused on our survival a lot. But what's been my joy is I focus on my clients, and therefore I'm focusing outwards all the time. So that is a real privilege when you can care for other people. So going back to your question about resilience, I think I have always been resilient, but I also think that, you know, when I, in November 17, when I had a really scary moment, which was basically called a hallucinogenic panic attack, I'd never had panic attacks, but it was the culmination of 16 quite shocking financial and personal traumas that happened in our family over a 6-year period. And I can give them a number of 16 because that's what, when I started seeing a psychologist, I discovered that I had buried, through my resilience, had buried the impact that these things had had on me. And so my resilience, yes, I had grown a resilience muscle, because the more adversity you have, the more your muscle grows. However, I hadn't really learned to deal with those pains properly. And so they were still defining me a bit, and they were stopping me from valuing myself enough. They were stopping me from having the right boundaries around me. They were stopping me from having the self-worth I needed to care for myself. You know, there was a huge journey that I went on through 2018 that actually gave me more deeper resilience. And it then allowed me to choose the life that I wanted, because I think I'd got on an ambitious conveyor belt that I didn't know how to jump off. And I think that experience said, actually, is my life defined by what I really want it to be? And so, you know, I wrote a post about this whole, which I'd love to talk through with you, actually, because I know you'll have thoughts on this whole world of share your vulnerabilities, which Brené Brown has encouraged. There is a lot of, that's brilliant. But what I discovered about myself, which I've always shared my vulnerabilities, is that in just talking about my vulnerabilities, I thought I was dealing with them. But actually, I think it's not enough just to talk. And you have to actually sometimes dig deeper than that and go through some therapy and heal in a much deeper way. I don't know what you think about that, Lou.
Well, I agree with you. I think that it's ultimately internal work. And for me, I need to do that quietly on my own. And whilst it is great to be able to talk to people that understand and want to help and want to support, they can't do that journey for you. And you sort of, if you've got stuff to sort of unravel and face and come to terms with, you sort of have to do it. You just have to face it and do it and do it in the way that feels right for you. And I definitely am someone that needs to quietly sort of, like a kind of wounded animal, go and lick those wounds and dig deep, really.
Yeah. And I really deeply believe in therapy. Now I've experienced it. You know, I've read self-help books and I've got a positive mental attitude, but actually our brains are so complicated. The way that they're constructed through lifetime of experiences, I know that I needed to go and sit with somebody who was professional, who could help me to dig into a lot of my subconscious belief systems and thoughts. And I went through something called acceptance commitment therapy as well, ACT and EMDR, which is another form of sort of hypnotherapy.
I wondered whether you felt that by going through that in that sort of that period, that you kind of uncovered everything, because I found that I've needed to have some therapy to deal with something. And then further along the line, something brings up something that's deeper. So then go back to therapy to kind of deal. So it's almost like the onion layers have been sort of revealed slowly over time, and that I've had to sort of go backwards and forwards. Or did you feel that you managed to kind of get right down to the nitty gritty in that period of time?
I definitely resonate with what you just said, and I'm going to come to that, because even now I'm starting to discover that even though there is absolutely no practical reason, I still have fear energy inside me. So I do understand what you're saying. But part of me says, actually, we all have fear energy because it's a human condition. And TJ Power, my son, who does a lot on mental, he's done a degree and master's in psychology and does a lot of work with mental well-being. We actually have, I think it's, we have a three times more propensity to notice fear than notice joy. And that actually is because we're animals. And if we were out there, we have to be so heightened to notice the things that can challenge us and fear us. And it's how we use and channel that energy as humans that we have to learn to manage. And I'm just going through a process of that again myself, because I couldn't understand, it might be because I've come off HRT as well, but I couldn't understand why I was starting to feel that sense of scarcity and fear again. But in answer to you, I went into deep, deep therapy, okay, with a psychologist. So I didn't go to a coach. Mine was, I chose to go, and that to me is like going into a brain surgery. And I chose to confront some things that I could talk about very easily. One was the rape of my daughter. I could talk about it at a superficial level, but I knew that there was some deep scars through it that I needed to investigate. Also, some deep scars around the loss of Academy, because for 14 years it had really defined us. And when it failed or had to come to an end, it just had really deeply ingrained a belief system around the fact that I could never achieve again in the way that I felt that I wanted to contribute to the world. So it did require some really courageous, and when I say courageous, I mean, you would never sit and do it on your own. I had to take myself through something called EMDR and talk through stuff that I would duck out of very quickly. And actually, I can give an imagery about this. So if you imagine a graph with two axes, and one axis is emotion and the bottom axis is time. And if you created a bell curve on that axis, so our emotions go up the bell curve, yeah, until they peak. And then when they peak, there's your extreme emotion, right? When they peak, and then it comes down the bell curve. And as it goes down is the bell curve, there is your brain is actually accepting something. So if you half that bell curve, on one half, it's your short-term memory. On your other half, it's your long-term memory. So as you're peaking down, you're actually filing an experience in your long-term memory. And what I learned was that most of us go slightly up that emotional curve, and then we loop off it and we circle round, and then it comes back again, and then we loop off it because we don't want to do it. When you go into deep therapy, you're actually encouraged to go all the way up to the very top of that, so that you are properly experiencing it and filing it. And what happened at the end of that, when I did that process through EMDR with my psychologist, the last one I faced was the experience that I had with Hannah. So I went through financial ones. I talked about trolling. I talked about the death of my niece. I talked about the death of my brother. I talked about experiencing my mum's dementia. I talked about some severe bullying that I'd had from investors. So I talked about many things, but I couldn't do Hannah's. It took about 5 months before I could deeply do what happened to Hannah and go into acceptance. And the opposite of acceptance is resistance. And so what I learned was that sometimes until we truly accept something, we resist things. And so it was deep, really deep and beautiful. But when, you know, each time I went through this, you know, a child, when they're really upset and they cry 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 and they cry, and then they get that for a while. Well, you know, when I did the Hannah one, I was still for about 24 hours. That's how deep it had to go. But it liberated me into understanding and then being in a place where I'm a much stronger from it. So resilience, it can sometimes have to be a strategy.
You have two phrases in your book which sort of describe that experience and the experience of sort of going through Academy and all of the things that you had to go through. And one of them was death by a thousand cuts. And the other one was a Japanese saying or phrase, kintsugi, art of precious scars. Mm. And I wonder if you could give some context to that journey of creating Academy. And it really was like death by a thousand cuts, that, you know, it was one thing would happen to you and you would find a solution. You would work to find a solution, and then something else would come along, and then you'd work to find. So it was this, you were really using your resilience. I mean, I guess storing the pain for that later therapy. Can you give that context of your vision for Academy, and then the sort of journey of it slowly being eroded from you?
Yeah, and I'll try and do it so that it's not, when I talk about it, so it's more general as well, so that anybody listening isn't sort of hearing my biography. It's more about what are the learnings from it. So the thing is that a lot of us build a business nowadays from a sense of purpose and passion. You know, Simon Sinek, you know, all the start with why, it's very powerful. And we create the energy around our passion. And that's a love energy, isn't it? It's very much a love energy. I love doing what I'm doing, and I love the impact that I'm going to have on someone. And the Academy was definitely built with love energy, 100%. You know, I was at home with three children. They were under five. It was 1998. I had read a book called Celestine Prophecy, which is quite a spiritual book. But I'd also read a book called Permission Marketing by Seth Godin, where it talked about turning strangers into friends, friends into customers. And I really like that. It's a brilliant book. I mean, it was written pre-internet, but it's a really clever book about the philosophy of the social world, actually. Anyway, I wasn't working very hard at the time, but Friends Reunited was around, and MySpace. And I had actually built a community of 630 people selling computers into the home as a consulting project for a company. And I had 630 agents on email. And I turned to my husband one day and said, look, there must be a way for us to build a community for business owners. And at the time, Thomas was very much a, people were always contacting Thomas because he was getting really into the internet space and saying, Thomas, do you know anyone who does this? Or can you connect me to this person? And he was it was constantly passing through him. And I said, if we built a community, we put all these people that we know into the community, they'll find each other. And I said, but let's do it so that they are friends with each other. So it was built, I had no expectation that we were starting the world's first social network for business.
So this was even before Facebook, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was before, it was 4 years before LinkedIn, 6 years before Facebook, 8 years before Twitter. So it's the first social network. So I just started at home. The kids were at home. I was still breastfeeding TJ and just started it as a little community. I paid somebody to build a website with community, the code to be able to allow people to connect with one another. Also the ability to write a post, which is blogging now, where you could share, they all had a profile so they could share who they were. And we said, this is about who you are as well as what you do. And it was incredible, but of course it grew virally. And so then we needed to get an investor because we couldn't afford to build it, to pay for the servers and everything. So then investor came in, and then Thomas's business had to be wrapped into it because he was very involved in it, but he was running a really good business and public speaker, but the investor said, no, Thomas needs to be in it fully. So then suddenly we both became completely invested in it, and the business was growing. And at the time we didn't have a business model really around it. But then we started to charge people £10 or $10 or 10 euros to be part of it. And they were paying that. They had no problem. So that's software as a service, I suppose, of its time. And then it grew all over the world. And then LinkedIn had come in, and we actually encouraged our members to learn LinkedIn. We told them about it. We used to run lessons on how to use LinkedIn because we were only caring about the member and whether they were going to grow. And, you know, they used us as their home. And then Facebook came in, and then Twitter. So we were constantly running courses how to use these other networks and sending people to them because we felt safe that this is a home where it's a different environment. But, you know, it was impossible for us to get investment. And people would come to the door of Academy and say, well, why would I pay for that when it's free on LinkedIn or free on Facebook? So then it became this huge challenge. And then members would say, don't go free because we like the fact that we have to pay for this because we people are pre-qualified, plus you can't have any fake people because you know by their credit card who they are. But anyway, it's a long story, big journey of death by a thousand cuts. In the end, Thomas and I were over £1.5 million in personal debt keeping it going. Barclays at one point were going to buy it so that they could put a community into Barclays. And then the day we were going to sign that was the day that Bob Diamond was declared a bad person on the front pages with the banking crisis. The lawyers said, no, we can't buy you. Then we got a loan from Clydesdale Bank, and we had a five-year loan. We were 2 years into it. And then they went, and like a lot of banks, and we were one of 6,000 businesses they did it to, they pulled the loan before the 5 years were up. And by then we were living in a rental property. We wouldn't have anything to guarantee against anymore. And it had to come to an end. So why I'm sharing it in that way is that you build something from passion, you learn the business skills along the way. And I had to learn how to be an entrepreneur. I had to learn how to be a business person, not just purely build a business based on love. I had to learn uncertainty. I had to learn to live with the fear, financial fear of risk. But I had lost control of myself and of a business. And in the end, you're waking up actually not knowing why you're doing it anymore. So, you know, there's an area in my book, I think page 18, when I say, when do you know that your business is no longer feels personal to you? Because basically we had a business that we couldn't have the intimacy with our clients anymore. We were running a machine. There wasn't any joy in it anymore because it was just full of fear. It came to an end, but it left us really, we lost our identity from that. Because we were identified as the people globally who had built Ecademy. And not only that, we had 650,000 members who it was their home, but we just couldn't afford to keep it going anymore. And they weren't willing to pay more for it, which is an interesting thing about this world of free. You know, if something's got value, pay for it. You know, that's, and that, you know, I'm really passionate about the fact that so many purpose-driven people do too much for free. You have to learn to have your boundaries around that and have a business model that enables even the most needy people to have access to something that will help them without that being your time.
Well, I think you're a pioneer in that as well, because that model, the subscription model, I mean, it did go through that massive period of everything being free, but it's sort of come back round, hasn't it? Where, you know, with online memberships and mind groups that you do, more and more people are taking, are building businesses around the subscription. So you sort of had the vision, the world just hadn't caught up with you.
Yeah, and that's hard. I mean, there'll be people listening to this who are trailblazing something and wondering how they can get that message across. And what I would say to people is what's so important is you build your own personal brand. And that's what saved me, is Penny Power had a brand, Thomas Power had a brand. We didn't build a logo called Ecademy that when it went, you know, people knew who was behind the business. People knew how aligned our values were to that. And it's been consistent. And actually, what I do think is whatever I started 23 years ago, I'm still doing. I've just jumped into different vehicles to deliver that over time. It doesn't stop me from always having the same sense of purpose.
I think, you know, a lot of people have done very well through the pandemic, but there are a lot of people whose businesses have been crushed and they're kind of sitting thinking, well, you know, what now? And that was where you were at, weren't you, when all of that happened with Ecademy and you sort of decided to face all of your emotions, all of the things that had built up over the years, even beyond Ecademy. How do you in that period of time, you know, you've lost everything. How do you dig deep and find a way to start again?
Well, I don't think you have much choice in life to do that. You know, when my sister lost her daughter, Vicky, she just got married and she was very central to our family. We all live around Farnham. I've got 13 nieces and nephews. We're very, very, very close. My two sisters and my brother died, but him as well in Farnham. And my father. And so I remember saying to my sister, you know, how are you going to cope with this? And she said, Penny, there is no option. You know, whatever adversity we face, there's two directions you can go in. There is giving up, literally, and just, you know, financially becoming poorer or emotionally becoming completely wrecked and suffer depression and lose control of your life. There is another way. And that is where you have to dig deep inside you and find the courage to go on and believe that you can create a beautiful future again. And I'm not wanting to simplify that. I'm not going to say it's easy at all. But I think you do need to stand on the edge of that cliff and say, which direction am I going to take? Am I going to step backwards and create a great life, or am I going to go forwards and jump over the cliff? You know, I am driven by love, which I don't want to sound too fluffy in that way, but I really do believe in love in business. And I am driven by positivity and I'm driven by happiness. And, you know, if I've still got it in me to spread that even through just one single post on LinkedIn or one client that might want me at a particular time, then I know I've got my purpose still. And so it is about knowing what your purpose is and really digging back into it. And I have to do it regularly. On the walk this morning, Thomas and I were talking about, we were both tired. We're both very tired. I think there's a lot of people that are very tired at the moment. Plus we had a virus, not COVID virus, last week, worked through it because we had a lot of commitments. And we were both tired as we were walking around the walk. And I literally said to him, right, you know, let's not focus on work. Let's focus on what we're doing for others. Let's not think about this week as work. Let's just think about the people that we've got that we want to help. And as soon as you do that, when you lift yourself out of yourself, you find the energy again. Energy comes from that. Energy comes from our purpose. So, and it's a bit like going back to what I learned as a little girl with Toby next door to me. My energy came from that little bright smile on this little boy who was wheelchair bound and couldn't feed himself when I arrived at his house. And I think the more we can, I think we have to, as we come out of this pandemic, remember there's a world outside and a world that needs us, and dig deep into, well, what is our little contribution to the world that can make a difference to one person today, whether it's a smile in Sainsbury's at the lady on the till and a chat. You know, as soon as you start doing that, you come through those dark moments.
So how did the concept of business is beautiful? I mean, obviously you'd been living it, but as something that you wanted to create, well, first of all, you wrote the book and then you started to build, I don't know whether you would call it a brand or a way of being in business. So how was Business is Personal born?
Well, Business is Personal is a philosophy to me. It's been a number of things that I've heard along the way. I've always believed it's about the people and how we treat one another. So I've always believed it's personal. When I was 19 and ended up being in a telesales room for an IT company, to me, all my clients were always, it was always personal and caring about them and going out of my way. I remember when I became a sales director quite young of quite a large company, I was 24, and we were a distribution company and we had £80 million worth of stock of Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft and all these computer software and hardware companies. And there were five other distributors in the UK exactly like us. And you will compete on margin all the time. You know, we've got it in stock and we can supply this and we can get it to you next day. But when I became sales director and the product managers were put under me, as well as the marketing team, Liz Harwood, you know, and sales team. So I had about 170 staff. The first thing I did was I said, right, I want everybody to tell me, all the product managers to tell me what stock we have. And if we're out of stock of anything, you ring round all our competitors and find out who does have it. And tell our sales team. So when somebody rings up and says, have you got a Hewlett-Packard LaserJet and we haven't got it in stock, tell them who has got it because they need it. It's not about us. That dealer needs it. So in the end, we became the first place a buyer would come to accidentally because they always knew we would tell them where the stock was. But that wasn't driven by a strategy like that. It was driven by, I care about that other person. So business has always been personal to me in everything that I've ever done. And a number of years ago, after Academy, I started a business called Digital Youth Academy, and I got some investors involved in it. And one of them brought in another investor onto the board, gave some of their shares to that investor and brought them onto the board. And this lady was not my cup of tea and I wasn't her cup of tea. She was a very fierce woman. And after the board meeting, I first met her. We were walking to the tube and she said, you know, Penny, I don't need to like you. It's not personal. It's just business. And having gone through the trauma of Academy and now find myself on quite a toxic board of a company that I had founded again, I couldn't believe it. And it took me 3.5 years to exit that company in the end. But the board was really toxic. And anyway, I was doing a speech and a guy called Scott Keyser heard it. And I talked about the fact that business is personal and I shared some of the reasons I believe business is personal. So when I was writing my book, I hadn't given it a title. And I met Scott accidentally at a TEDx talk in Kingston. And he said to me, I hadn't seen him for about 6 years. And he said to me, do you know what I've always remembered? And it's my mantra every day that you gave me permission to say that business is personal. So I said, you've just given me the name of my book. So I just think as a philosophy, and I hear people now saying to me, business is personal, isn't it? Which is actually interesting because the mantra used to be, it's not personal, it's just business. And I'm switching it round. And so I wrote the book in 2018, and it's not a biography, but I share myself more as a torchbearer and a subject, and not as an expert, just so that people can know that I have empathy and I understand them, and that there is a way to regain control over your business and give yourself permission to make decisions. Like, I mean, it's great. A client of mine said to me, I just sacked that client last week. I hated them. And I thought, you're taking control. And I think if we can all take control of our business and mold it into something that we love. And somebody told me that there are three areas of happiness. So if you've got 100% of happiness, 50% is your constitution, whether you are a happy person naturally, 10% is the achievement of the things you want, and 40% is whether or not you feel in control of your life. And so if your life does feel out of control, you have to look at what areas it's gone out of control and get back into control. And then you're likely to come back to 100% of happiness. And once you're happy, you will build the business you want.
Do you mean that to be sort of autonomy? Is that the same thing?
I think it's, yeah, it's about knowing that, you know, if you've taken that brave step to have your own business and not get a salary, there's got to be benefits to it. And the biggest benefit is that you are free to choose your business model, free to choose when, what hours you work, what clients you have, what suppliers you have, and be aware and sensitive to your own vulnerabilities. So, you know, I have clients that say, I cannot use Instagram, it depresses me. Well, then build a business that doesn't use Instagram. I mean, deep down, they've got some issues around comparison maybe or whatever. But you first of all need to know what triggers are making you feel your business isn't giving you joy, and gain back control so you can get back into joy. And know that there is no one business, it's not a cookie, there's no cookie cutter on what a perfect business person is. You're made up of all your past experiences, your traumas, your adversity, your joys, the people that you love, the experiences you have, the expertise you have, how you manage to communicate it. You are such a complex mix that you cannot try and be like someone else.
And so with that in mind, how, what's your vision for your future?
So I'm 57 now. I hope to work forever. I don't have any desire to not work because I see my work as joyful and impactful. And there's nothing better in life than to feel you're having impact. I think we've got something very special with BIP 100. What's happening in there is quite phenomenal because Thomas and I facilitate a beautiful space for other people to grow and become the heroes within it. I'm not the hero within it. And so there's no ego in this. It's very much how those 100 people, we've only got 46 so far, so we're still looking for 54. But how do we curate people that have a diversity of expertise, but a commonality of kindness into it? And it is quite amazing to watch what's happening inside it. And so I think we will stick with that model. And I can't see, unless the internet fell down, I can't see how that will be disrupted. We don't have investors in it. It is very aligned to Thomas's and my values. They will be having monthly dinners as well, which I do believe in the offline. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it opens up in that way. So whether or not there'll be more BIP 100s, I think that's intriguing because I think there are more people that we could help to run BIP 100s for them in their area. Thomas and I aren't the only people that have this leadership style and we can help people. And so I am going to be interested, but not going to even go near it until we know that BIP 100 is right and we've got the 100 people in there. But I imagine there'll be some BIP 100s that might emerge and say, we've got ones in New Zealand. We've got three in New Zealand, one in Greece, one in Portugal, one in Ohio, one in Zurich members. So I would love, it's almost like Academy 2.0, but the BIP 100s that Thomas and I have will always be our BIP 100 group. So it's very special. So maybe it will grow out from there. but it won't grow out at speed. We don't want to start running a machine again.
The symbol of this podcast is a hand, and written on it, it says, choose courage. And I believe that at every fork of the road, we have that choice to make. And so I wonder, with all of your experiences and challenges, how you define courage?
Gosh, that's an amazing question. I think courage is about understanding when you need it to begin with, actually knowing I am having to be courageous now. And it's the moment when you go from your comfort zone into your discomfort zone. And so that's when you know what courage is. How you achieve courage, I think you have to dig very deep inside yourself and know that you have no option than to step into it, step into that new place. And, you know, we have such a short time on earth. And if anything is holding you back from being courageous, you need to work around that and maybe get help to do it. I think small intimate groups, what I believe in, the closeness and love of others will help you to be courageous. But I would define courage as something we all have to do. We're all animals. Nobody is entitled to have their food put on their plate and a roof over their head. In fact, you're caged as an animal if that is the life you have. And so you have to realize that and accept that life is about major courageous moments and realize that we all are exactly the same doing that.
Well, I feel like your whole approach to business, your whole approach to your life, to the way that you've dealt with things along the way, it feels like a real breath of fresh air in the business world. And I can see why people respond so well to this philosophy that you're building and evolving and allowing to blossom. So thank you so much, Penny, for giving a whole new empathetic way of doing business, connecting, sharing, listening, and serving your own community whilst taking care of yourself. Thank you so much, Penny, and see you soon. Take care.
Thank you, Lou. That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Penny, for giving us the insights into why business really is personal and how we can have a healthier relationship with ourselves and our businesses by embracing that. You can find out more about Penny's work at www.bip100.club and follow her on Instagram at Penny F Power. Thanks to Silk Studios for producing and sourcing the guests for the show. And thanks to you all for listening. Take care, choose courage, and see you next week.